We're rolling.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about Mercy. Mercy Me.
Is that a game? Did you ever play Mercy in elementary school?
The hands?
Just make people say Mercy?
No, I have weak. I have, at least at the time. Of course, now I have very strong hands, but at the time I had weak hands. It also makes me think of before we moved back, I think I was at home. I came home to visit. And Mercy Hospital did this ad campaign, and it was this, like, African-American guy. I don't think they were on a cruise ship, but it was, like, a cruise ship type of commercial.
Yeah.
And they were saying, oh, mercy, mercy me, and people were, like, dancing around. So when I came to Mercy, the hospital, I was like, hey, I used to see that commercial. And everyone was, like, very embarrassed by it, so it was funny to me.
Well, it's fitting, then, that we're talking about Mercy, not only because of that experience, but also because... some people formulate the three things that we're supposed to do in Lent as fasting, prayer, and mercy. It's almsgiving, but some people suggest mercy as another way to think about almsgiving.
Well, to me, I don't, like, frankly, I don't have a very good picture in my mind of what almsgiving is. I think of, I know it's not the same, but I think of palms, like Palm Sunday, and then palmsgiving. Which I know that that's not what it is. So for me, I think, you know, if I use the term mercy in my mind instead of almsgiving, it's a little bit more tangible to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we don't... Well, it's also just a more common word. But, and then finally, it's a good topic to talk about because we're in the year of mercy. The extraordinary jubilee year of mercy.
So in preparing for this... you know, because really I didn't know, I really don't have a lot to say about Mercy. So I was listening to these different podcasts, and periodically people will use the idea of mercy as a topic. And some of the podcasts that I listened to, there's like a cardinal that talked about mercy, or, you know, some other people. And it was really vague. It's like, well, you know, Jesus, he talked about how this one cardinal gave the example of how when Jesus appeared to his disciples in the room after he had died, and he said, peace be with you, that he was basically pardoning them for, like, abandoning him and for all these things that they had done. And that was an example of mercy. And because of that, that's where the idea of mercy comes from. And I think that's true, but it seemed a little bit of a, I don't know, not a stretch per se, but it wasn't a clear link to me. Like, is that really where the mercy comes from? But then what was interesting, and I just mentioned it to you, but in another one, like this Institute of Catholic Culture, which does all these lectures, this one guy was talking about how the directive for mercy comes from Leviticus, which I may have never read, but I didn't realize that it actually is... It's not commanded, but it's like specified in there that there's like whatever these years. I didn't really listen to a lot of the podcast, yeah. But I was like, oh, this really comes from someplace. So,
yeah, it does. In fact, Leviticus, which is a bunch of laws, one of the first five books of the Bible, and there were laws for the priestly class, and so they're broadly divided into three different types of laws. You have laws of sacrifice, which the priests offered on behalf of the sins of the people. You had laws of purity, so this is where our laws, or the laws of the Jewish people, you know, prohibiting eating certain kinds of animals and things like that, and then laws regarding the Jubilee. It's the vast majority of Leviticus are the laws of sacrifice and the laws of purity, but yeah, then you do have these laws concerning the Jubilee. And so seven was a significant number in Hebrew culture. And so the idea actually was every 7 years you kind of had like a mini celebration, as it were. And then 7 times 7 is 49. And then so on the 50th year, it becomes an extraordinary celebration, as it were. And the idea was that for people's debts to be forgiven. And I guess at that time, you know, average life expectancy probably wouldn't have been 50, would have been closer to 35 or 40. So if every 50 years you have debt forgiveness, the idea is that for someone who's been born into debt, for someone who'd been born into their parents' debt, you know, they get that absolved and then they can start fresh. But the other side of it that is very clear in Old Testament history is there was a real commitment to social justice, right? That
really in the Old Testament?
Yeah, and that's where you'd get that, right? Because a lot of people think of Old Testament law as being an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, which there's a lot of that in there. But time and time again, there's within Leviticus and Exodus, you have God calling the Hebrew people specifically to look out for the orphaned and the widow and the stranger. So those three are specifically mentioned. And then in the year of Jubilee, that debts are forgiveness and that land is kind of redistributed, right? So there was a sort of a social justice kind of equalizing of material wealth that happened. And so that's where Catholics at least get that tradition of the Jubilee from.
That's interesting. I truly had no idea. I kind of laughed. It had nothing to do with it, but we were just watching Lord of the Rings for the first time on TV. And I've been explaining to Matthew what who the orcs were, and he just had in mind that they're orphans.
Hmm.
So he kept asking about the orphans, like, are the orphans going to be attacking the city? Are they going to fight the orphans now? And I'm like, no, it's not the orphans, it's the orcs. So,
yeah, the orphans are not the bad guys.
I also like this idea of the debt forgiveness. So every 50th year, was it a year of mercy per se, or was it a year of some, like every 7 years, was that like a forgiveness or a mercy kind of theme, or did it rotate with other, does that make sense? Does it rotate?
No, in the Old Testament, it was just called the Jubilee.
Okay.
And it was always about debt forgiveness.
So it wasn't necessarily mercy, but it's in the line, in the spirit of mercy then.
Right, it is, yeah.
Because, you know, when, I don't know, probably in church or whatever, when they had said this is, Pope Francis has declared this like the Jubilee Year of Mercy.
Yeah.
I just assumed that it was, I don't know, I didn't realize it came from someplace. I just thought he had sort of arbitrarily chosen, like, this is the year of mercy, like, as if he would have been saying, like, this is the year of peace or the year of love or the year of sacrifice or what, you know, of anything, you know, just like probably like a lot of maybe schools or institutions or organizations, they may have a theme for the year. Like, this is our theme for, of whatever, giving or of penance.
Well, no, there is, that's what makes it the extraordinary year or Jubilee year. I mean, the Jubilee year naturally happens every 25 or 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the church sort of has that built in to the structure. And this year is not one of those years. So in that sense, it is kind of a arbitrary kind of thing where the Pope says, hey, this year we're going to celebrate a year of mercy. But it does speak a lot to how he feels the church needs to be positioned in the world. And so right before this, I read that the Year of Mercy, which is this liturgical year, is the 50th year anniversary of the end of Vatican II, right? And the whole point of Vatican II was to open the church to the rest of the world, right? And to be seen as not this sort of cold, closed-off place, but a place that was warm and open and welcome and inviting. And that is very much what Pope Francis seeks to do as well. I think that's what his message and what his approach has all been about. And I think he also feels that mercy is what Christ has to offer that makes the church inviting, right? People don't want to go to a church to be condemned. It's like, okay, I'm going to my weekly shaming on Sunday. You want to come and feel, have that experience of mercy or of forgiveness or of acceptance.
You know, it's interesting though, because as much as I agree, and I think that's appealing, for myself, and I would gather, I would just imagine for other Catholics too, being on the receiving end of mercy or forgiveness is actually sort of hard. Like, for instance, when I go to confession, it does feel great. It is like, without sounding too cheesy, it is this kind of amazing feeling of relief and, I guess, compassion and mercy, mm-hmm. you know, when at the end, you know, whoever, Father so-and-so would say, I don't even know what they say, on behalf of the church, I absolve you of your sins.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. That's really amazing to me, and it really is like this weight lifted. And thankfully, these days, I have a lot less of things that I'm carrying around to feel guilty about than I did, you know, a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But as much as I'm grateful for that, it must be either during the time and definitely before the time where, I don't know if it's like a disbelief or hesitation or fear that it's not going to be forgiven or that it is shameful or embarrassing to, you know, articulate my sins and, you know, the things that are weighing on my heart. And so it's an interesting thing that you're right. I think people do like to go to church for some sort of validation and feel that they're good and they're okay. But then when it really comes down to it, and it's not just in church. I think it happens through relationships and in all aspects of people's life. But this idea to feel like either loved or forgiven or accepted, it's a curious thing that we, or rather that I would struggle with it. I mean,
well, it's countercultural, especially in American culture, because we're so used to being able to think of what we receive as a direct response to our actions, right? Mm. So
what we earn.
We earn, right? Yeah. So we, obviously, when it comes to work, we make a certain amount of money because we earn it, right? And if we don't earn it from working hard, we earn it because we have something of value that other people don't have. And that's why we deserve to get paid what we do. And even in relationships, I mean, there's a kind of sense in which, yes, this person may love me unconditionally, but we don't really acknowledge that. I mean, because the fact is, if you sort of cut off all kind of support for the other person, chances are they will stop loving you, right? And that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, I think, you know, we would understand if love wasn't reciprocated from one party for the other person not to give it, right? So the idea of mercy, I think, is countercultural because it's not a transaction that happens in response to what you achieve or what you earn, right? It's freely given.
And I have to say my initial but part of my response to even the term mercy is, well, not part of it, my response to the term mercy itself is mixed.
Yep.
In our American culture, here and now, I think things like mercy, I guess it depends on people's worldviews, but it's not necessarily seen as a very, like, it's seen as a positive thing, but not necessarily like an aspiration or an admirable thing.
Right.
Like, we're going to hire this guy because apparently this guy is just really merciful.
Right.
So it's such a great attribute. Let's hire them. Or I hope you grow up, Matthew, I hope you grow up and you're just a really merciful man.
Right.
You know, the things that I think of kind of on my base level, I want him to be intelligent. I want him to be strong. I want hope to be, you know, confident and, you know, aspiring in the things that she does. It's fairly low on my list, I guess, when I think of things. As much as I might value it, it's not the first thing that comes to mind to want my kids to be merciful men and women. When I think about who I want to be, I may want to be a better, like a more affectionate husband, a good teaching and educating father. And mercy I certainly accept and I want to be, but it's definitely not, I really want to be a merciful person. You know, part of, even in like when I watch the news and, you know, with whatever, politicians or the government, when they deal with other countries, I don't always want them to be merciful. After 9/11, I was not like, oh, this, what a great chance for us to be merciful towards right. those. Not at no, all. That was not like, a no, common. We should just bomb the heck out of that place, smoke them out like Georgia, you know?
Yeah.
And so at least, and I don't know how it is in other countries, but at least in our modern American culture, in my perception is that mercy is seen on some levels as weak or passive.
Yep.
And at the very, and I guess on the other end of the spectrum, a good thing, but maybe not the top of the list.
Right.
But as you're talking, it does seem like mercy should be one of the top, you know, components or attributes of our faith.
Yeah, and to tie that in, I think you see that, as you mentioned, in terms of politics, and we see that in terms of any institution. I've seen it in schools, in Catholic schools, right, as administrators are trying to decide whether a student should still be allowed to stay in the school or not. And there'll be arguments from all sides, and people will say, well, he has not lived up to the academic expectations. He does not submit work. He's been disrespectful to teachers. But then you hear on the other side, well, he's dealing with all these issues at home. He has, you know, psychological issues that he has to sort out. And, you know, this is our chance to show as a Catholic institution that we're an institution of mercy. And so it's always interesting to be part of those conversations because there is a real fear just – just as you've mentioned, that the institution could be perceived as weak. You know, that if we never kick out a student, if we always allow students to stay, then the institution loses its credibility, mm-hmm. right? Because then when a student passes or a student stays or a student gets its diploma, the question will be, well, what does that diploma represent? Mm-hmm. Does it represent actual achievement, or does it just represent the unending mercy of this particular institution?
Yeah, it's not seen as a positive thing. You know, talking about that, it's very similar things are happening, you know, in the unit where I work. I work in a neonatal intensive care unit, and our unit is a family-centered unit, and this is at Mercy Hospital. And so, you know, parents can come in at any time. Anytime, all the time, to see their children, because we value the, you know, the family unit. We really want to encourage that connection, as if the baby were home with them. Hmm. You know, you wouldn't say in your own home, well, you can't be with your baby from these hours. No, it wouldn't make sense at all. And so, but what has happened recently is there's been some instances that have been alarming or concerning to a lot of the staff. And so, you know, we are downtown in Baltimore, and so we have a lot of different families and parents that come. And so what has happened, not just recently, but it's just been coming up more in the most recent weeks, where, you know, due to high levels of frustration or stress or fear, whatever, parents have spoken things or acted in certain ways or done certain things that actually made the staff feel very unsafe.
Hmm.
And so the staff sometimes have... and the staff and the leadership have taken steps to address it, but then at the same time, a lot of the, you know, the hospital and the institution, the organization as a whole, is still trying to preserve the family unit. So even though it may be in the best interests of everyone at some point to maybe say to someone, you know, maybe, you know, it's not appropriate for you to be here right here now,
mm-hmm.
It's not a standing thing where we're barring parents from coming onto the unit.
Right.
Because despite those, the management, you know, I don't want to keep saying the management, but like the hospital really wants to make it, wants to not just make it a priority, but really wants to demonstrate its priority to the family. And so there is this like competing level of like, well, you know, if people are acting like this, whether it's not good grades or not academically performing well, or if they're not adhering to acceptable behavior standards in the hospital, it makes perfect logical sense that they would have some sort of repercussion. And how do you manage that? Or how do the people having to make that decision even integrate that with this idea of mercy, you know, mercy and forgiveness for the students, mercy and forgiveness to the parents, for perfectly great reasons. But in that particular instance, it can be a hard thing to try and, you know, mix it all together with.
Right. And one of the things that stuck with me is in these discussions, again, with students, and similar to what you've been saying about how do you balance between wanting the families to be together and wanting families to be present against the safety of of everyone involved. A teacher had said something fairly similar, and someone was talking about how the school needs to show mercy to a student, and this particular educator stood up and said, "I think our mercy needs to be tempered by justice," and you know that the two go hand in hand, and while we want to be merciful, and while God is merciful, God is also just, right? And so as much as we say that there are opportunities for forgiveness and there are opportunities for people to come clean and there's opportunities for people to recognize the love of God, there is also a rich tradition, both scripturally and sort of traditionally within the church, of seeing God's justice. And both in the Old Testament and in the words of Christ, we have a warning of what can happen when we don't turn our hearts back to God. And that as a whole, God is not someone who is whose justice will be denied. Let's put it that way. And I think it's hard, and maybe this is just us being limited, finite humans without, you know, the infinite knowledge to comprehend how a being could be both infinitely just and infinitely merciful.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking, it seems like it's difficult to do both. You know, it almost seems like, I know that you're going to say it's not, and I would say, you know, I'd probably expect that any priest or anyone would say that it's not, but it seems, as you're talking about that, as much as it makes sense to me, it also seems like, well, maybe the mercy is conditional.
Right.
I know that the teaching is always that love, you know, God's love and forgiveness and mercy is unconditional.
Yeah.
But it sort of seems like it is conditional. I mean, even when I go to confession, there is some sort of penance involved. And I do have to go through the process of confession. My understanding is, I mean, I think there's, I don't know, like the, I actually don't know like all the finite details, but it doesn't seem like you can, even within the eyes of, in the eyes of the church, rather, that you can just do whatever you want, anytime you want, and because God's love and forgiveness is unconditional and bountiless, that you can just do whatever, and you always are experiencing His mercy. It does seem like there is, at the very least, tempered by the justice or a process or whatever, but it also kind of seems like it's conditional.
Yeah, well, I do think this gets to one of the things I've been thinking about. I do think the two feed off of each other, justice and mercy, that is, because I think that mercy becomes powerful and it becomes truly merciful when it's set in the context of justice. In other words, if you think of a parent who's sort of never getting his child in trouble, right, or never scolding the child or never giving any kind of punishment and just allowing the child to do whatever they want all the time, then, you know, that for that, you know, 100th time that the kid breaks it, you know, throws a glass on the ground intentionally and shatters something, and the parent says, "Oh, you're still little, you know, I won't get you in trouble today." That's not mercy in that sense, I think. And it's not mercy because there hasn't been a pre-established condition of justice that's already been set. And so I think in that sense, mercy, maybe these conditions that you've mentioned of mercy, the condition that by which mercy stands is through the context of justice, right? And so in that context, I think what that educator was saying about that student, he's right, that we are, as an institution, as a Catholic institution, mercy does have to be tempered by justice. And I think what that would mean is that anytime a case comes up, we can't automatically default to giving the kid another chance, right? I think the default has to be justice. And then mercy then becomes not necessarily an exception to that justice, but the flexibility to it, right? To be able to say that this justice is important, it sets the ground conditions by which we run our institution, and yet we're not bound to these rules, right? That at the end, there is a higher order of love or a higher order of compassion or a higher order of, you know, the promotion of life or freedom. And in order to get that, we need both justice and those moments of mercy to be free to emerge.
I like that because it doesn't make mercy seem so weak.
Right. Yeah.
I can't say it. Mercy alone is not, invokes images of strength or feelings of strength. But within, you know, cradled in that context, then it is like, okay, so now there is still like this feeling or this context of stability, of strength, of justice. And so I don't know, either for me as a man or an American man or whatever, it's, you know, I'm always sensitive to, is this something strong or is this weak? Is this something good or just, or is this like going to erode, you know, some of that foundation, you know, whatever. And so maybe some of my thoughts, initial thoughts or reactions to mercy is, you know, based in that, because I never really thought of it in that way, but I like it.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I wanted to ask what your thoughts of mercy were in relation to something like Sayo, right? Which would, in terms of defense, encourage people to be proactive in terms of mindset, yeah. Right? You know, and is there room for mercy in the context of a self-defense situation?
Well, you know, I thought of that because when I think of, you know, Pamana Tohon Sayok in the Sayo Kali system, as dangerous and capable as he is and the system and organization is, he is not an inflexible person, nor is he a stone cold, just one dimensional tyrant. He's definitely not that. And it's interesting, talking about martial arts just in general, one of my favorite martial arts like mottos / t-shirts is Cobra Kai. I had this Cobra Kai t-shirt. It was actually awesome. It had the Cobra Kai symbol. And on the front, there was like a fist, and there was the words around it. It was something that, like, you know, whatever John Kreese had said. I think he said it actually in the movie, but I liked it because I think it was probably the same logo that they had on their shirts. It said, strike first, something like, hit hard, strike first, no mercy. And then, you know, even in Karate Kid, he was always like, no mercy, no mercy. And it was simultaneously sort of cool, but since it was against Daniel-san, you know, that was like, oh, well, look at these guys. No mercy. That's like, those guys are too bad. That's too bad. But I think in general, you know, when people are thinking about like fighting or doing whatever, it's not a critique at all. I'm not speaking on it in any kind of way. But I would imagine if you're in like a Krav Maga class and there's an attacker, that the first thing in your mind is probably not mercy, mercy, let's show them mercy. It's probably no mercy. I'm going to, you know, attack as hard and as strong as I can. And so even in that way, you know, it's the idea of mercy is this weird dichotomy. It could be empowering, but also I think some of the empowering components of self-defense is to not have mercy, right? You know, to be able to show strength but I guess that it does go hand in hand, because I think, you know, the great benefit to martial arts, particularly traditional martial arts, is that it teaches a lot of control, self-control or self-awareness. And so I think anyone would argue that no mercy, because there's no control, like you're just no mercy because you're just, you know, some sort of maniacal
killing machine.
Yeah, that's not necessarily good.
Right.
You don't want mercy because you're just so weak. Like, mercy is by default, like, because you have no option, you're just so weak. Like a teddy bear is merciful if I'm punching it because it just has no other option. I think it's admired when someone has mercy, when it is dished out in a controlled kind of way. Like, they have control of themselves and stuff like that. In a martial arts perspective, yeah, I think a little bit it's hard to reconcile because most of us take the position of the person that's going to be attacked,
right,
or that is attacked.
Right.
If someone describes a situation, let's say they on the news there's like a report and someone says, in Baltimore today, a woman was struck by a man and she had to go to the hospital, automatically we are thinking, oh, you know, like, oh, that's a terrible thing. We automatically empathize with the victim, really.
Right.
But what if the context was the woman was trying to steal this man's baby, so he punched her.
Yep.
So that he could get away. Now, if, you know, now kind of it's interesting in that framing of justice, then we're like, oh, well, That's okay.
Yeah.
But initially, not necessarily for good or bad, it's just initially I think a lot of people's default is to empathize with someone who's the recipient of some sort of violence or attack or whatever. And so since we do that, the idea of mercy is hard to manage, you know, because like, oh, well, why would you be merciful if you're going to be attacked? But if the fact is that that guy punched the woman because he didn't want to hurt her further or do something, then it's like, oh, that showed some good restraint, whatever it is. And, you know, it's an interesting thing to manage because I think it's easy to think about martial arts very one-dimensionally as in whatever dimension it would be, as, you know, Karate Kid wearing pajamas doing karate, or whether it's MMA, or whether it's just aggression,
yep,
like punching faces. I don't know whatever it would be. It's difficult to integrate it until you actually look at things on multiple levels.
Well, what I take from that also is that sense of mercy as being something that's controlled, and I think that's what makes mercy not something of weakness. Right, I think you have to be in a position of power in order to truly exhibit mercy. Right. If you think of, for example, like government showing mercy to a convicted criminal, or today's parable of the prodigal son, you know, the father with mm-hmm. wealth
yeah.
showing mercy back to his son, or a hospital caring for children that can't fend for themselves. Yeah. The mercy is in the context of those with power, right? And so there's a sense, and this goes back to the justice piece, the institution or the individual that cultivates justice and therefore has the ability to truly show mercy is only able to do that because he's had the power to cultivate that justice in the first place. He's had that power to implement and set into place the conditions by which mercy can emerge or can be granted. And so in that sense, mercy might not be, you know, this idea of, again, someone being beat up and being like, you know, saying to the attacker, oh, I won't fight back because I'm merciful to you. Well, if you couldn't fight back in the first place, it's not mercy. It's just, you're just getting beat up because
yeah.
you're weak, right?
Yeah.
And that's the end of the story, yeah. right? But if you could, and you could fight back, and not only fight back, but then possibly kill or severely disable your attacker, and maybe have a right to do so under justice, and then choose not to, then that's where mercy can be truly powerful. But again, only because you've had that power in the first place.
And it makes me think of Jesus in kind of a different way, because a lot of times when throughout the Gospels, when people have said to Jesus, like, well, if you really are the Son of God, then where are your angels to save you now?
Yeah.
Or like, where's, you know, like basically like where, even as a reader, like, okay, so where is Jesus's army? Where is his kingdom? Because, you know, in this moment when he's getting, you know, he's, you know, whatever, getting put in these situations because of maybe an innate sense of justice, or I want something to change. I'm like, man, doesn't Jesus just want to just destroy these people? Or, you know, there's something very sort of satisfying in the Old Testament when God was like, okay, Noah, I don't like how things are going. You yeah. can build a boat. I'm sort of gonna start over and right. just flood the earth. There's something sort of satisfying about that. Or even in the small glimpses, even if it doesn't happen, when, you know, Jesus would hint at like, well, I have like armies and kingdom and angels in heaven that could be there. But you're like, oh yeah, I want to see it.
Yeah.
But then doesn't. But I guess if framed in this context, then he is super merciful, infinitely merciful. If at any time he could call on, you know, the armies of heaven to just crush his oppressors and, you know, do just things, and he chooses not to, because of the mercy. That's a nice thought, but it also makes me think, you know, we've been talking about a lot of things very conceptually, which I like. I like these discussions, but it makes me think, like, in my daily life, in the daily life of a Catholic, a regular American Catholic, Baltimore, Maryland, right. American Catholic.
Yeah, how do we live out
mercy? So, yeah, like, how, yeah, it's cool. Be merciful. So if someone came into the house, they're trying to do something, and I'm Mr. Miyagi about to punch, you know, chop them in the neck, and I decide to honk their nose instead. Yeah, aside from those, you know, vicarious, you know, instances in a movie, me wishing that it might happen so I could do that too. Aside from those, in my daily interactions, how do I live out mercy?
Mm.
Aside from, like, extraordinary situations, you know, like, and I think most people like this. I'd probably say the great majority of people are not the majority of time in positions of power for everyone around them.
Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm. They may not be teachers or bosses. I mean, there's a lot of those too. Principals or bosses or supervisors or something. If you're just like a regular person, I mean, and even if you are, but even outside of that, even if you're a supervisor at work, for instance, you probably don't supervise everyone in your life. You're probably just a supervisor or have some sort of role, position of power in one aspect of your life. So, I mean, aside from just the nice thought of it, how do we really live it out? Because I feel like it's easier to be loving, possibly forgiving, but to actually exhibit and act out mercy, act it out in a way that's reflective of our faith and what we believe. How, I mean, I could be rhetorical, but it could be also, like, if you have any thoughts, like, how do we do it? How do we live this out?
I think based off of our conversation, and by the way, I was thinking the same thing. You know, how do we live this out in a practical day-to-day way? Based off of our conversation, I think part of it is cultivating a life of justice, which includes cultivating a life of power. Right, you mentioned that people in their everyday lives may not be in a position of power to exhibit mercy. And if that's the case, then maybe one thing that we need to do is to cultivate power. Right. Yeah, and I don't mean that in a Donald Trump power hungry kind of way. But I do mean that, that could mean career, that could mean in terms of, you know, financial power. But I think anyone that's in any kind of relationship, which is all of us, is managing a dynamic of power in any relationship, right? And that dynamic of power is one in which you are free to make decisions that will influence another person. And there are decisions that we can make that would be just and that would cultivate a spirit of justice within that relationship. Whether that be a relationship with a spouse or with a child or with a neighbor or with a coworker. And we're in a position then to enforce the conditions of that relationship such that it is just, which means at times saying no or choosing to do things that will not make another person happy or not give them exactly what they want. And I think that would be the first thing, is establishing, you know, conditions of justice within a relationship. So that might mean, you know, if you're a teenager and you sort of say, well, I'm kind of powerless. I have to listen to my teachers. Now I have to listen to my parents. You know, how can I be merciful? Well, part of it is you can also, even as a teenager dealing with parents or dealing with a school, you can insist on justice, right? So you can refuse certain demands, right? Or you can refuse certain requests, or you can speak up against certain things in the spirit of justice and say, this is not just, or this is not right to me, or this does not promote the growth of those around me. And you can speak up against that. And then within that context also, there are times in which those relationships, whether it be parents or whether it be teachers or whoever else might be, everyone just by default of being human will make mistakes. And so again, cultivating justice, I think, means calling people out on those mistakes, yeah.
Right? So even if it's a child saying, hey, mom and dad, you messed up, right? And I felt bad about that, right? That is an act of justice.
Yeah.
And I think if a child never does that, then they also never have power, right?
Or even cultivating power internally for yourself.
Sure.
Not in like a chi, I mean, cool, if it's in a chi way.
Yep.
But also just in how you, you know, in a kind of a Sartre kind of way, how you perceive the world and how you view things.
Right.
One of Guru Dan's, you know, senior students, guy, Sifu Guru Kevin Seaman in New York, he does a lot of motivational talk and coaching and stuff like that. And he talked about how we
in general, we all have these perceptions of control, how we can control components of our lives. But he said, and I really liked it, he says that there's really only three things we can control. The mental images you have in your mind, the words you say to yourself, and how you respond to situations. And you're right, so a teenager that's like frustrated, maybe feeling pressures from school, or you know, maybe in college or whatever it is, I think sometimes developing that power and that justice, and related to that, even mercy, even to yourself, I think, I'm really thinking out loud and processing this as I talk, but I think that's true. It all is linked and tied together.
Yeah. Like, so for example, for that person who puts so much pressure on himself or herself to succeed all the time, mercy is vitally important. You need to show mercy to yourself to say that, you know, I'm a human being and I've made mistakes and I'm still loved and I'm still worthy. And that act of mercy to yourself is crucial. But then again, that only becomes crucial and only becomes significant because that person had already set up a system of justice within themselves.
Yeah, we're not aspiring to those people that are like, hey, it's all right,
People are just making excuses for themselves all the time, right? Yeah. So in that sense, the live out portion, I think, depends then on what aspect of your life you're talking about and what a given individual's going through and dealing with.
Well, that's helpful. I mean, you know, now when I look at – I was looking at the banner today at St. Joseph's, actually, the Year of Mercy, and it had like these – I mean, I don't know why I'm laughing.
Yeah, the doors.
Of know why I'm laughing, but I don't. You know, it shouldn't necessarily be funny. The doors are opening, like some light shining through the doors. Now, at least it won't seem so just abstract and amorphous to me. At least I have, you know, I have something to chew on now. Like, okay, so I have no idea if that's what Pope Francis thinks,
right?
But at least the way that I think about it. It's a little bit more fleshed out.
Well, and hopefully, and for me too, that's been the case, thinking out loud and processing these things. And hopefully that'll be the case for our listeners also.
Yeah. Mercy me.
Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy.